We'll move to the next case of the morning, which will be Will Tinner versus United Insurance Company of America. Mr. Doyle?
May it please the Court, Your Honor, Counsel. I'm James Doyle from Lake Charles, Louisiana, and I represent Mr. Tinner, the appellant, who is seated with me at counsel table this morning. The questions presented by this case are two. First is whether a peremptory strike in a Title VII civil case in the United States District Court of the only African-American juror on the panel amounts to a Batson violation. Secondly, the question is whether the trial court's pretrial rulings on summary judgment contain prohibited fact findings on the issues of discriminatory intent and the establishment of a pattern of discrimination. Now, with respect to the peremptory strike issue, we would point out to the court that since this is pending in the United States District Court as a trial matter, that it is governed by both statutory and constitutional considerations, which makes it a little bit different from most of the precedent that I saw in this circuit, which appears to deal with habeas corpus cases from the state courts. There is a statutory command in the federal courts that the peremptory challenges granted by 1870 be exercised in such a way that they not discriminate against jurors because of their race. And, of course, this is carried out in the constitutional context through a reading of Carter versus Greene County Commissioners, which recognizes that the juror has a due process right and an expectation which can be prosecuted by the litigants in a case.
Now, Mr. Doyle, in criminal cases, of course, prospective jurors are often asked whether they have been the victims of crime.
True.
Or whether they know anyone who has been convicted of crime. And, of course, sad to say, in this country, people of color are more likely to answer those questions in the affirmative than other jurors. Under your approach, wouldn't we have to consider excusing jurors based on those circumstances as a proxy for race as well?
Well, in some cases you would. I believe that in some cases, in fact, that has been the determination. There's a case where the prosecutor said that he believed everyone in East St. Louis was a victim of a crime, and therefore he believed that entitled him to strike someone from that area from a district court jury veneer. There's the case in this circuit where the prosecutor believed that being raised as a child in Gary, Indiana was sufficient to strike someone from a jury panel, and the court in that case did determine that that question was a surrogate for race. So I think it depends on how you apply it. But here, even though my argument still remains that the question, do you know anyone that's been a victim of discrimination, is a surrogate for race, I think that the facts of this case make it awfully close to a legal conclusion that the judge drew rather than a factual one. And this is what I mean by that. The record will show you in the voir dire examination of Mrs. Clardy, who is the African-American juror with whom we're concerned, was asked on six separate occasions questions which led to her answers that she could be fair, honest, and impartial as a juror. And yet, in spite of that testimony, it was the contention of counsel for the defendants at trial that they were excusing her because they believed she would be biased, quote-unquote. And the court accepted that explanation with no evidence at all in the record to indicate that she would be biased. In fact, all the evidence was to the contrary. Now, if you remove that...
Don't I recall the question, or specifically, do you know someone who has alleged or has filed a suit alleging discrimination?
Actually, she was asked... I believe, Judge, these questions. First, can you be an honest juror? That's
well, no, but the question specifically that we're talking about is ones, do any of you know anyone who's filed
Correct.
A suit alleging discrimination of any kind?
Correct.
If you do know, anybody know of or heard of anybody who's filed a suit alleging discrimination? And she, there were two answers, yes. One was, as I understand it, Caucasian. The other was not.
That's correct, sir.
And... both were excused.
Correct. Mr. Kuster was excused as the first challenged juror by the plaintiff.
Yeah.
He is the white gentleman to whom you referred.
Right.
He said he knew people through his business contact. Mrs. Clardy was excused
right.
as the first strike by the defense.
Right. But isn't there two sides of the same coin?
Well, I suppose that's always the contention that's made.
Well, no, but it's not always a contention, because that situation doesn't always come up where you have somebody who's white says that, yes, they were on the opposite. I know people in the opposite, and somebody who's black says the opposite.
True.
So that's unusual.
Except that Mr. Kuster was not challenged, and his challenge was not objected to by the defense on racial grounds, which it could have been. The right granted in the Constitution to a juror not to be excluded on account of race extends equally.
But do you see any? Well, wouldn't it indicate to you, by and large, however, that what you're seeking as an attorney is somebody who has experience with that particular crime, that particular act, is nil. It's not there. So you're not taking a wild chance. You can't date. I'm sure they both said that they thought they could be fair. But
well,
if you were interrogating somebody in a personal injury case, you'd say, have you ever been a plaintiff, or do you know anybody who's a plaintiff in a personal injury case? Somebody said, yes, and you're a defendant in the case, and they know somebody who was a plaintiff, and that takes care of that. You might be very much inclined to just get rid of them. That solves a lot of problems.
Well, I think that's true, depending upon the answer that you receive. Now,
well, if the answer is, yes, I know my mother was involved or some close friend was involved, it was a bad experience all the way around, why should you be compelled to take a chance at that stage of the game?
Well, I don't think you're compelled to take a chance. I think what you're compelled to do is to exercise your challenge consistent with the constitutional mandate and with the statutory law.
Well, I agree with that.
And I believe that in this case, the problem that I have is not with, and I think the problem that Mr. Williams said, is not with the answer that the witness gave. There was no correct answer to the question as far as Mr. Williams was concerned, and that's my point, because even though she maintained throughout that she could be fair, he just didn't believe her, and the court basically made a credibility determination of her, not of Mr. Williams.
Well,
so it's not the question, but the answer.
She said it would be hard to say whether her sister's claim would affect her judgment in this case.
True, but she couldn't.
I'm sorry. And that her sister had described her ordeal.
She did use those words. She said it would be difficult to say because she didn't know the company's side of the case. And she said that she knew her sister looked at it as an ordeal. So I think that that's another way of saying I can't make a judgment as to whether my sister was right or wrong. And then right after that, she's asked, can you be fair? And she says, yes, I can. And said that she, I don't mean to interrupt you,
sure.
But she said she could be fair even though she was informed by counsel that there would be evidence in the case that his client, supervisor, used a racial slur to describe Mr. Tenner. She said that wouldn't bother her. So I think she went over backwards to show that she could be an open juror. I'm sorry.
Okay, thank you.
I found a case from the Illinois State Court that I think is relevant to this kind of issue, because the concern, of course, is that if this is a constitutional right, then it can't be dealt with lightly, and I know that this court does not. The Alvarillo case comes up, and I cited it in my brief because it contained what I believe is unfortunate language, which describes the process as dancing the Batson jig. Well, I don't believe that's sufficient when you're dealing with a constitutional right. The Randall case says prosecutors are often given, should be given a manual that says handy race-neutral explanations or 20 time-tested race-neutral explanations. I don't believe it's sufficient to say the right word or to be a clever advocate. I think that you have to make certain as a judge that the constitutional rights of all are protected. And if there aren't any further questions, I'll reserve the remaining time I have for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Williams?
May it please the court and counsel. This court in 1990 in Durham versus Frank's Nursery and Crafts joined the 11th Circuit in leading the country by applying the Batson rule to civil cases before the U.S. Supreme Court made that move in Edmondson. So this court has always, I think, led the country in this area. There is no evidence that United Insurance strike of Miss Clardy was anything other than following the procedure and meeting the standard set forth in Batson. Instead, Mr. Tenner would have this court do away with the requirement of proof of a discriminatory intent, holding that as a matter of law, the criteria used to strike Ms. Clardy in this case cannot be a race-neutral explanation, because the criteria may disproportionately impact minority jurors, minority members of a jury pool. The rule Mr. Tenner seeks this court to make would, one, require overruling well-established Equal Protection Clause jurisprudence, and two, would undermine the right to trial by a fair and unbiased jury. As the panel spoke to in the initial presentation, the question before the jury panel was, do any of you know anyone who's filed a suit alleging discrimination of any kind? We had two jury members respond to that. One, a white male, Mr. Keister, who said he was president of Keister's Hardware. He had had an EEOC claim for racial discrimination filed against his company. It was denied. It didn't go anywhere. He thought he could be fair. He knew discrimination existed in the country, and he thought it was wrong. Plaintiff, quite properly under his peremptory challenges under statute, struck potential juror Keister. Likewise, Ms. Clardy, a black female, responded that she knew somebody. And she said, my sister has before. And I'm quoting now from the transcript. I said, your sister has before, okay. Do you think the fact that your sister has filed a lawsuit alleging discrimination, do you think that would affect your determination here? Ironically, that question is nearly identical to the question that plaintiff's counsel asked Mr. Keister. Mr. Keister, the fact that your firm has had this experience before, do you think that would affect your deliberations here? Mr. Keister said, I don't think so. What did prospective juror Clardy say to that question? It's hard to say because I didn't go through the courts with her. Basically, I knew what happened or what she told me was her ordeal. Well, looking at a definition for the word ordeal, if we go to Webster's Dictionary, 1996, ordeal is a painful or difficult experience. And that's a unique word to choose to describe your sister's, one, service as plaintiff in a lawsuit, two,
I don't think that's unusual. I'd call it an ordeal, too, I mean, under any condition.
Well, that may be. It may be an ordeal on a daily basis, I guess, to do work. But it was a unique word in terms of description. She first off said she didn't know whether it would affect her opinion. She didn't say, yes, it would, or no, it wouldn't. She was ambiguous. Her sister had filed a similar claim, and she did describe the claim as an ordeal in her case. The court very carefully considered, first, was there a prima facie showing of discrimination? Yes, there was. The plaintiff raised the objection. We responded with the race-neutral explanation for why she would potentially have her, it would color the jurors' views going into the jury room. There was any question whether there was any additional information from the plaintiff in determining it, and Judge Young found that the plaintiff had not met their burden to establish that there had been some racially improper reason for striking this juror. As we look at the precedent, the Supreme Court precedent that would be applicable to this case, the U.S. Supreme Court rejected the very argument Mr. Tenner now makes in Hernandez versus New York, holding the prosecutor's use of peremptory challenges to strike Spanish-speaking venire members because he feared they would not rely on the official court transcription of Spanish testimony. The Supreme Court specifically denied to rule that exclusion of bilingual jurors should not be permitted as a matter of law because the criteria disproportionately impacted a minority. Disparate impact may weigh into the trial court's determination at step three of the Batson analysis, but is not conclusive as to discriminatory intent. This holding was affirmed by the Supreme Court in JEB and by this court recently in Alviero versus Sam's Warehouse Club. The purpose of the Batson inquiry is to protect the constitutional guarantee of equal protection, as this court knows. Contrary to Mr. Tinner's assertion, his only right, as exposed in Holland versus Illinois, is to a jury which has no member who has been purposely excluded because of his or her race. As Batson states, the standard is to articulate a neutral explanation related to the particular case to be tried. And in this instance, the claim that was raised by the family member was a discrimination claim. We don't even know the type of discrimination claim that Ms. Clardy's sister may have raised. It wasn't clarified whether it was race, age, gender, religion, disability. Certainly all of those potential forms of discrimination are ones that any potential member of the jury, potential jury panel could have responded to. The three-step Batson inquiry properly turns on an analysis by the trial court's judge whether or not the strike was made with intent to discriminate. As this panel knows, intent by its nature is a fact-sensitive inquiry that must be conducted by the trial court on a case-by-case basis. Further, the rule Mr. Tinner seeks this court to impose today would erode the right to a trial by jury, an impartial jury, and frankly render Batson as a procedural designed to enforce the protection of the Equal Protection Clause actually meaningless. The purpose of voir dire is, of course, to assure selection of an unbiased jury. It is precisely for this reason that the strikes were made that we've already discussed. There are a couple of cases that address this issue in an employment case. The Tenth Circuit, one of the two circuits that we have found that have addressed a similar issue in an employment case, is stated in Hino versus Sprint, 208 F3rd 847, a Tenth Circuit case of 2000. There, a juror's belief in affirmative action and belief that he had been discriminated against by his employer were race-neutral reasons for the strike. Similarly, the Eighth Circuit also held that the employer defendant in a race discrimination case articulated a race-neutral and truthful reason for use of peremptory challenges against two African-American potential jury members who believed they had been unfairly discharged in their employment in Doss versus Frontenac, 14 F3rd 1313. A rule that Mr. Tinner seeks that would be used by United States never can, as a matter of law, be a race-neutral reason would frankly render voir dire meaningless and further erode the peremptory challenge. While this court does possess broad supervisory powers, exercise would be inappropriate here. Mr. Tinner cited two very old Supreme Court cases, one the Thiel case in 1946, where the district court clerk and jury commissioner both testified that they deliberately excluded jury lists of all persons who work for a daily wage. That, the court found, undermined the integrity of the judicial process. Likewise, in McNabb in 1943, they violated the statute. But use of the peremptory challenges in the situation presented here by Mr. Tinner did not undermine the integrity of the judicial process. On the contrary, it allowed parties to conduct thorough voir dire so that there was a specific reason. Also, the standard should not be changed, the standard from clearly erroneous. There is certainly no basis for change of the standard to a de novo one. That is one reserved for summary judgment. Clearly erroneous is certainly the proper standard to be applied here. And one of de novo, of course, as the court knows in summary judgment, all of the material that was in front of the trial court judge at the time of the summary judgment hearing is in front of the panel here to determine that summary judgment hearing. This court cannot supplant itself and be in Judge Young's shoes to evaluate the circumstances and the facts that were going on in the trial courtroom, and that is why a new standard would be inappropriate in this case.
Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Doyle.
May it please the Court, Your Honor. I remember Dunham versus Frank's Nursery and Crafts with great fondness because it came out right before I argued the Edmondson case before the Supreme Court. Of course, the difference there is that Mr. Dunham, the plaintiff, came back to the Seventh Circuit, ultimately to the trial court, and did not get a new trial because it was found that the defense counsel did not violate Batson, and in my case, Mr. Edmondson settled his. The Gary, Indiana case is Roberts, and there Judge Easterbrook said that the proffered reason for striking a person from Gary was so flimsy that the question of pretext had to be raised. This was a case here, Mr. Tenner's case, where the evidence broke down along racial lines. I think you absolutely have to look at the totality of the circumstances as revealed on the record. And Justice Cardozo in the People versus Randall, Illinois case that I mentioned to you, which is 671 Northeast 2nd 21, or 60 rather, page 60, was quoted in that case from a 1920 opinion. He said, "We are not to close our eyes as judges to what we must perceive as men. When you review this case in its entirety, you will see that Mr. Tenner was discriminated against both by the company and by the process. He faced a jury upon which no Negro was allowed to sit. And as the court of the Supreme Court of the United States said in Avery versus Georgia, he was therefore justified in believing that a jury upon which no Negro is allowed to sit is going to treat him the same way. Ultimately, that's what happened to him. We believe that he deserves a new trial, and that's the relief that we seek from this court." Thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks very much. That case will be taken under advisement.